This is EdgeCases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf French.
And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
The past, present, and future of file systems.
Oh, boy. Well, that's not a giant topic, I suppose.
it's one of these things where my outline is way off the end of my screen.
Well, we better get to it then.
Okay. Is there no follow-up or anything?
Don't think so.
Okay, well, I'll start at the beginning then. In the beginning, at least in terms of the Mac world, there is the Macintosh file system. And as you being the noob to the Mac, which is the meme apparently I'm spreading, with the incorrect meme, but scandalous, libelous, I guess, probably more. But I actually, because of my having a 128K Mac and all that, I actually used the Macintosh file system. And it actually didn't have a very long lifespan, but obviously it was originally designed for 400K floppies, and it was actually really cool in a lot of different ways. It supported long file names, which at that point, and for a surprisingly long time afterwards, DOS had the 8.3 file name limitations, and I believe the file system structures themselves supported 255 bytes. And practically like 64, initially they supported like 64 characters, but then for some reason the Finder limited you to only 32. But anyway, it was a lot better.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it supported, each file had two forks, the data fork and the resource fork. And of course the resource fork was structured to hold the resources of you can basically, you can think of it as like kind of an arbitrary metadata system of structured data, kind of like a mini database type thing of every file. That was pretty awesome. And it also had really great metadata for its time. Probably the most famous one were the file types and creators that each file had.
Mm-hmm.
And Mac OS X has had Unix underpinnings, we've gotten used to the file extensions type stuff again. But
yeah,
it's amazing how used to it we've gotten. And this was such not a Mac thing to do, but we went through this period, this desert of like lack of metadata in Mac OS X. And now we're rich in it again, but there was like that, there was like, from 10.0 to 10.3 or something, that where it's like, oh, metadata's bad, you shouldn't have any of that. And it kind of sunk in, and now we're metadata rich again, but I guess that's right. For drop reasons, we still just use the extensions everywhere, which is pretty sad.
Well, and the reason for them saying, well, get rid of all your metadata, was because they wanted to do better interchange with other operating systems.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that they kind of dropped that because they've added all this other metadata, which will still get stripped if you send it to Windows or Linux or whatever.
Sure.
And they just kind of said, well, okay, I guess that's not so important anymore.
Yeah. Well, now that Apple owns the world, why would you need to interoperate, right? I mean, in all seriousness, though, it was, Apple was in obviously a much weaker position back then, and, they were on the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I suppose.
They were not in position to tell the world how it's going to be. Another interesting piece of meta that I forgot, it was look at the Wikipedia pages, but the location of the file in the Finder's window was part of the metadata. Because that was part of the entire spatial finder types thing. And that's a very important piece of data that should be associated with each file. Although it was always kind of weird that if you, you had different size screens and you, shared a floppy disk with someone, where that icon would end up, somewhat unpredictable, but it was better than the alternative, which is kind of what we're kind of living with today. And the main thing about MFS that was kind of really interesting, probably not in a good way, but still interesting, was that it didn't have any real directories. That in the Finder, you could actually create folders, but they were a figment of the Finder's imagination. Like the Finder had its own little file that kept track of these so-called folders, and it wasn't actually part of like the file system itself. And so probably the most notable kind of leaky abstraction thing that you'd see is that in the open save panels, dialog boxes, as they were known back then, that the folders weren't presented. So it's like, the Finder knew about them, but the part of the operating system that actually showed the open and save panels didn't know about them. And so you just see like a file to save all your files. So in some ways, actually was kind of neat but we didn't actually have, type ahead search boxes back then. So if you end up having hundreds of files, they'd all just kind of just be plopped down in front of you. So it was not such a great thing.
Well, it's interesting that that's kind of what OS X most recently has shown when you open a Finder window, in that they have that All My Files meta location that kind of shows you everything if you scroll down long enough.
The All My Files thing, I don't know about you, but I immediately get rid of that.
Yeah. Can you get rid of it?
It's a preference that you can control what's in the sidebar in the Finder preferences. But I immediately turn that off, and it's not because I don't like the idea. I actually do kind of like the idea, but I worry about it from an implementation standpoint. Like, it's walking my hard drive to give me my infinite list of all my files, and it immediately freaks me out that it's doing a lot of work that will eat up my machine forever. And so it's probably, implementation wise, probably actually efficient or something like that. At least I'd hope. But yeah, I understand what it needs to do to do that. It scares me.
Okay.
And the other analogy I thought you were going for, but you started talking about Mac OS X, was that the entire thing about the folders being a figment of the Finder's imagination was the groups in iOS, right? They have applications inside these groups. That's that's a springboard's figment of the imagination, that's not actually represented in the file system. And so it's less applicable because obviously on the Mac you deal with file systems directly, and iOS is all abstracted away from you. But it does seem like a bit of an analogy back to the 1984 Mac. And so MFS, the Macintosh file system, was limited to only 20 megabytes in size, which turned out to be a problem because in 1985, Apple introduced their first hard drive, which happened to be 20 megabytes in size.
Coincidence.
Yeah, I think MFS probably would have worked on it, but Apple bit the bullet and designed the hierarchical file system, or HFS, that we're still using a variant of today.
Oh, are we?
Yeah, man, 1985. So that's coming up on 2 decades? Wait, it's... Three decades. Wow.
Coming up, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Coming right up. And the way things are going, I don't think we'll be, shuffling off the HFS model coil.
Yeah.
I think we're going to be celebrating 30 years of it.
Yeah, you and Syracuse have been moaning that.
Yeah, it's actually funny because I was really cramming for this, and I actually did not end up linking to any of Syracuse's articles, but that is definitely the kind of – he's been beating this drum for a long time. And yeah, it's one of these things where I know his arguments so well between his writings and the podcast is like I almost didn't need to refer to it because it's hot in my cache. So HFS actually added those directories and was able to support greater than 20 megabyte volumes. Before there was a flat file on the Macintosh file system that. It was pretty primitive, especially once you start getting past 100 files, it would degrade, I think actually worse than linearly in terms of speed. So that was pretty bad. And so they end up using B-tree structures for HFS. So it was kind of a grown-up file system. And actually, it turns out that you still can mount plain old HFS volumes on a modern Mac, but
yep.
Circa 10.6 is read-only. So you can't create new ones and you can't modify them.
Yep.
And so circa 1998, with Mac OS 8.1, Apple introduced HFS Plus. And it basically was addressing a bunch of the limitations that HFS had. And the big one seemed to be the fact that HFS had a allocation table that was limited to 65,000 entries. And so what ended up happening is that I think that was as many files as you could store on a hard drive with 65,000. And it also was something like each file would have to get much, much larger because you had to basically divide the size of the hard drive by that many allocation blocks or to address each one. And so if you had a file with 1 byte in it, it'd end up actually taking 16K on a large hard drive. And that was...
That's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was crazy.
Yeah, that was a quote-unquote a large hard drive back then. And I mean,
right.
I couldn't imagine what the size of the files would be on these 4 terabyte monsters we have today.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was – so HFS Plus was kind of – they had to update a bunch of 16-bit fields to 32-bit. And that was the primary thrust on it. But probably the coolest thing about HFS Plus was the HFS wrapper. Have you actually ever seen this in person?
I've heard various things about it. I'm not sure.
So HFS Plus was basically implemented as it looked to be so I told you it was introduced in macOS 8.1. So imagine if you create a HFS Plus volume in 8.1, and then you plug that hard drive into an 8.0 Mac. And what would happen is that it would show up, and it would show up as how it was implemented is that HFS Plus was actually embedded in an HFS wrapper. And it was very clever, I thought, of Apple, that there was a single simple text document in there called, "Where have all my files gone?" And when you opened it up, and it was weird because I had underscores in the name, it was kind of weird, but so you opened it up and it would explain to you, hey, this is actually an HFS Plus volume and all your data is there, it's just you can't see it. So you need to upgrade your Mac, or you need to plug into a Mac that's already been upgraded.
So the data, they kind of embedded enough data for it to feel like an HFS volume to code that was only looking for HFS volumes.
Mm-hmm, right. I don't know if they implemented like the HFS Plus as being like this one huge invisible file in an HFS volume, or if they pulled some other trick, maybe two partition headers or something. But it was a very clever trick, that is kind of the usability that I like to see coming out of Apple. What happens when the user does this thing that could very well happen? The common thing, and I don't think I've ever seen anything else other than this, is just saying unsupported volume system type.
Sure.
And having that little friendly simple text file there telling you what you can do and your file's safe and all that, that was a really interesting technique. I really was really happy to see that. So the journaling was added in macOS 10 server 10.2, and then it was made default in 10.3, and that was a biggie. And it's very interesting how they were able to bolt that on. It turns out journaling is one of these important technologies that can save data corruption. I'll talk a little bit more about journaling a little bit later, and. Then you have HFSX, which is actually our current file format, volume format, which is HFS Plus, but without the wrapper. So I guess those days of macOS 8.1 back in 1998 are long behind us, that Apple decided we don't need the wrapper anymore. So they stripped the wrapper out.
You just get the candy. You don't get the wrapper.
There you go. And that's what we're using today, is a journaled variant of HFSX. And over the years, Apple's been continuing to add on to HFS, but in kind of an in ways that are kind of build on it, instead of having declaring a brand new file system format. In 10.4, they added inline attribute records and they added ACLs. And ACL still kind of confused me. I pretty much stay away from them. And 10.5, they added directory hard linking, and that was pretty much just for Time Machine. And how they implemented that is kind of crazy, that there's this directory at the root of all hard drives called with like null HFS Plus private data. And inside each hard link is its own file, which basically represents that level of indirection you need to hard link directories, because you can't represent that directly in HFS data structures. And so Apple's been doing a lot of stuff like this, where they kind of like are basically kind of adding more information to HFS, but instead of tweaking the data structures directly, they kind of build on the file system services that HFS itself offers. And it's kind of weird.
Yeah, I would tend to think of it as patching.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not like they're not adding other interesting things like hot file clustering and on-the-fly defragmentation. But as we know in 10.9, now they've even added tags, but although that's more of a spotlight technology. But that itself is interesting. It's one of these things where it's like, in some ways it's like utterly disgusting what they're doing. But in other ways, it's like, hats off, man. I mean, you've been able to extend this pretty elderly format for and bolt on these pretty impressive new features for a very long time. And it's obviously like Apple is no longer seem to be chomping at the bit at like creating a brand new file system. And that a lot of engineering goes on to kind of like adding these HFS features in terms of HFS itself. So, I mean, we are suffering data loss here, and which I'll talk about a little bit later, but mostly it's working. So you got to kind of respect the engineering that's going into this, that they're kind of able to have this mismangled format they have to work with, this old thing, and they're able to keep on bringing it forward and doing new things with it. Okay, so so along the same lines, I mentioned that, you know, they're kind of doing new things with it, and one of the new things that they've done is a logical volume manager, which is, we know it as core storage. I think it was introduced in 10.7, and that's when they changed File Vault from being File Vault 1, which was a encrypted sparse image based implementation, to a full disk implementation. And also Fusion Drive, which is that Apple's technology that allows you to pair an SSD with the traditional spinning Rust platter system that will use the SSD as a – you can kind of think of it as a cache, but it's better than that, where it will move files back and forth and it will try to improve – give you SSD-ish speeds while having the large capacities of your old spinning platter systems.
Yeah, I really wish they would introduce that for the laptops.
Yeah, but you can understand why they were. I mean,
yeah.
It's platters on laptops. Like, that technology is over. I don't think Apple's ever going to like add another disk to. I won't think they'll ever introduce a new notebook that has a hard drive in it. They'll all be SSDs from here on out. Yep.
Sure. Yeah, but which means that hard drives on laptops are going to be too small for, you know, a good long time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you're coping with this, but I have a Mac Pro that I have stuffed with hard drives, and I've moved my files into archives on there, and I would say all my essential files are on my MacBook Air, but obviously not nearly enough room for me to store all my photos and everything I want to store. So I just use that as an adjunct storage. Of course, now with the new Mac Pro being all SSD internal, it's like that, even that strategy is untenable.
Yeah. Oh, well.
And so Apple, with the entire like core storage thing and the logical volume management, that, you know, again, they're kind of like creeping along, and they keep on adding new things. I mean, that's kind of a very fundamental thing that they added. So that's sure, actually pretty impressive. And again, engineering type thing where they don't disrupt HFS again, but they kind of like, now it's kind of put inside the core storage basket. And
yeah,
it's this very interesting direction. It strikes me as very much kind of like the Objective-C style thing, where it's like they keep yeah, on really. Iterating on it, right? And adding these things. And
I just have to think that like they've got these poor file system engineers, you know, who really want to write something new. You know, they've got them like chained in the basement of like, you know, aisle 4 or something. Like, no, you're going to give us what we want. You are going to suffer. So, you know, because I get, my God, you know, it's like 10 years, right? You said it's like almost 30 years now. Yeah. But, you know, the real, of the work that they've been doing on OS X, that, you know, major changes to it without, as you said, without really changing the underlying implementation, mm-hmm. that's been going on for at least 10 years now.
Oh, yeah, probably even more than that.
10, 15?
Yeah.
Like, my God, I can't imagine being on that team.
Mm-hmm. At least with like the Objective-C analogy, is that, you know, they got to have a new 64-bit runtime where they got to fix up a lot of stuff.
Yep.
And you don't.
Well,
get
and they
that.
Got a new compiler. They got a completely new compiler.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but you know, those bits on disk have to remain compatible.
Yeah.
They don't have to, but you know, that's the way Apple's going forward.
Well, and again, it seems to me, and it's maybe better for the wrap up, but it seems to me that Apple is is very gung-ho on making its third-party developers jump through hoops to stay compatible. And yet they won't do that with their own users and their own software. Mm.
Interesting. Yeah, I could see that. One thing I mentioned about the directory hard linking that was added for Time Machine is that one thing that I was surprised is that with 10.5's implementation with Time Machine is it copies files. And I thought that was I had issues with it, but so you're going to use this implementation for 10.5. I figured they would have a transactional system in place for 10.6 or later, and they haven't done that. And Windows actually has something like this, and I did a quick look up about this, and I'm pretty sure it's not what Microsoft is calling transactional NTFS. Instead, if you could register as like a backup service, and how it would work is that you could essentially request a snapshot of the like I mentioned, the journaling type stuff, right? So it's like as updates roll in, they're written to a journal and then they're applied to the file system. And the idea is that if you say what you're going to do and then you do it. And if you write down what you're going to do and then you crash, then when you come back up, you can just, what was I going to do? I'll do that. And what's interesting about using these type of journals or log files in file systems is that you can point to them at an arbitrary point, and you can say, okay, I want the file system to basically kind of be frozen in time. And because Time Machine does have some issues where if you copy a file while it's being modified, that it either the backup fails or it copies the wrong thing or copies in half update state or whatever. And Windows has some support for this where I know that a retrospect for Windows was it Retrospect? I'm not sure, but it was some famous backup program. I guess Retrospect actually probably isn't that famous on Windows, but maybe it is. I don't know. And they were able to essentially get a snapshot of the file system in the current state, so they could copy over a clean snapshot of that. And I believe there was limited buffers there, because there was a problem. Like, what if you're streaming video onto your hard drive while you're doing a backup, and you could easily blow the buffers in? And at that point, it'd just be your app gets a notification saying, hey, the buffer's been blown, and I can't give you the snapshot you want anymore. And you're like, okay, then I'll just have to restart the backup later. So that is a really great system, and unfortunately, I was surprised that Apple hasn't rolled out something like this. I think they view Time Machine as good enough, and like all of HFS. So, one I want to mention, before I go and get into the meat of the matter, I want to mention two interesting file systems, which is UFS and BFS. So UFS was the Unix file system, otherwise known as the FAST file system or Berkeley file system, I think, even goes back that far. But that was the file system used by NextStep and OpenStep. And, OpenStep with this Windows compatibility, I think they probably just used whatever Windows things they had going there. But it was dropped in 10.5, and it had a bunch of limitations.
Well, I'm surprised it lasted that long.
Really? When did Avi leave? Avi Tevenian?
Well, it was just, I think I even tried to run it with UFS when it first came out, and there were just enough things that didn't work very well with it. Mm-hmm. Although that's also when you say, you don't want to have metadata in your OS, some of it might have been because they wanted... The only way they could make that work is on UFS then was to make sure the operating system didn't use metadata, because you wouldn't be able to save it very, very well on UFS. So, instead of worrying about translating it to Windows or Linux, maybe they were just worried about translating it to UFS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also apparently, at least the version that came with the Mac, well, actually, I'm not sure. I read this on Wikipedia, which I don't think I ran into myself, but it had a 4 GB maximum volume size. So I'm sure that could have been extended out, but fortunately, that story of macOS 10's development is pretty much over, and I'm happy for it. BFS was very cool. It's part of the B operating system. It was actually their second file system, and the first file system was this BFS, and this one was BEFS. But so it's kind of weird. But they call it the old BFS and versus the new BFS. But anyway,
they didn't call the first one AFS.
There you go. Because there is an AFS. Isn't that the Android file system?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
Not me, though.
I don't know. Were you involved in it?
No.
Okay.
More than one Andrew out there.
And the BFS file system was quite cool. It was a modern 64-bit journaling file system. And it supported extended attributes. And those attributes were also indexed, which made it very databasey. And so you could run queries on these extended attributes on the files. And not only that, is that those queries were persistent and were live updating. So you could have write out a persistent query, save it off, and the file system would give you notifications as that as new items matched that query. That was, I believe, the BOS mail system used that extensively, and which is a little bit of a prelude of about Spotlight. The mail app on macOS 10 is operates along the same way in terms of like how it uses search. Like when you search for a subject line in mail.app, how that's working is that it's actually leveraging Spotlight. So this is kind of the prelude to Spotlight.
Sure.
And it makes sense because Dominic Giampolo, or Giampolo, I actually don't know how to pronounce his last name, but like all things, right?
Well, don't ask me.
he was the guy who wrote the BFS, and now he works for Apple, and he's been working for Apple for a long time. And so he was definitely involved in the Spotlight thing. But one thing that he wrote was a practical file system design, a book on it. And I bought this book when it came out. And this is actually how I learned how journaling file systems work from him. And he had a bunch of great insights. And he kind of delved into the philosophy about how file systems work and with concrete implementation deals about... details about how BFS worked. And so it's a fantastic read, and unfortunately it's out of print, but fortunately he gives away a PDF copy of it on his website, so I'll include a link to that. And if you're a file system geek like I am, it's definitely worth a read. It actually has a clear explanation about how journaling file systems work. I've read it anywhere, so that's pretty great.
Is that a particular, like, is it a chapter labeled journaling file systems, or
I think it's something like that. Yeah,
because I probably wouldn't want to read the whole book, but right. If it's a great explanation of journaling file systems, I might take a look at that part.
Okay, yeah, I think
I do remember when that came out. When that, you know, because you know by then of course BFS BOS was pretty much dead.
Yeah,
so you know it was nice to get some of that information out there.
Mm-hmm. And so now for the kind of the meat of the matter and kind of. Forms the kind of a touchstone that we can compare and contrast everything else with is ZFS. Initially, again, in my research, I learned that it used to stand for the zettabyte file system, but apparently today it doesn't stand for anything. You see, this is part of the problem with when I was reading about this stuff when it was all being announced for the first time is that I just learned tonight that it doesn't stand for anything anymore. Hmm. And
so, like KFS,
KFS,
KFS, KFC.
I was kernel file system. I was going along there with you, but yes, exactly.
Well, there's AFS, there's BFS, there's ZFS, right? Why not KFS?
Sure.
But no, Kentucky Fried Chicken does not have their own file system.
Yeah, well, didn't they for a while say that actually stood for Kitchen Fresh Chicken?
No, I don't remember that.
They did that
maybe.
For like, I don't know, 4 months or something. Yes.
It's probably better that it doesn't stand for anything now.
Yeah, right. And there was also an explanation for this that I also hadn't heard, is that they chose zettabyte because it was the largest likable SI prefix that apparently the largest international system of units, SI, it was YADA, and they didn't want to call it the YADA file system.
I can understand why.
So they went with zettabyte file system, but now it's a CFS. And it was created by Sun, and Sun open sourced it, and so it has an interesting history with Apple, that Apple... started implementing it, like to get it working on. I think they were targeting 10.5, maybe 10.6, something like that. But they seemingly were targeting Mac OS X server initially. I believe they had some beta downloads that you could flip the switch on OS X server, and you could actually use ZFS in some ways. And they seemed pretty happy about it, but things soured. And to this day, I don't know if the story has been totally has been written out.
You don't have any dirt?
Well, I did know that Jonathan Schwartz basically announced. He pulled what was that? Was it an ATI that announced the video card for the next Mac or something? And they end up being cut out of it. You know what I'm talking about? Was that NVIDIA? I forget. Vaguely. I mean, there were only really two players, so it was probably one of them.
Right.
But yes, so this is famous with ATI that they announced that basically that they would either they announced the next Mac or they announced they were going to be the video card the next Mac, and like, nope, you're not anymore. And so I don't know if Jonathan Schwartz announcing that ZFS was going to be in the next macOS was enough to burn that bridge, but I don't think that was enough. I think instead it was Apple lawyers doing their due diligence, finding out that it was horribly encumbered, and I believe NetApp was currently suing Sun for patent infringement, and I think they also heard the rumors that Oracle was going to buy out Sun, and Apple seems to rightfully understand that they should have no dealings with anything with Oracle. And yeah, so that was dropped, and it turns out that one of the Apple engineers that worked on it, Don Brady, he obviously really likes ZFS, so he created a company called Tens Compliment to do it on his own time and his own nickel and charge for the product. And I don't know if he's ever got to the point where selling it, but it was an announcement. And this outfit called Green Bytes end up buying Tens Compliment and released a product called under the name Zevo, Z-E-V-O. And I've heard a rumor, I don't know if this is official, but that's also for sale now. So there is also an open source project called MaxZFS that's on Google Code that I don't know what the product status of it, but long story short, ZFS on the Mac is in a very sad state, and I would not put any of my data on ZFS on the Mac. It seems like what versions there are out either are incomplete or are based on really old versions of ZFS. And there are like no GUI tools here. There's only command line tools, and you have to know exactly what you're doing. And so with much sadness in my heart, ZFS is probably not a story on the Mac and probably won't be anytime soon, which is pretty sad. Because I'm about to tell you all the reasons why ZFS is great, you can't have any of these. Probably the biggest thing for me and why I was excited about ZFS when it was coming out is that it focuses on data corruption. The fact that it can store mass amounts of data is almost secondary, and I think rightfully so. Like, its primary purpose seems to be protection against data corruption, and it turns out that they advance the state of the art in so many ways here. So there's a bunch of causes for data corruption. There's loose disk or power cables. You can have power spikes or fluctuations. You can have dropped writes, where a write that you think would happen just flat out doesn't happen. Of course, you have the all-time favorite, cosmic rays, that can flip bits on you behind your back. there are firmware bugs. One of the things about kind of the end-to-end data protection offered by ZFS is that they discovered so many bugs in shipping drives and RAID hardware that were never exposed. They flip one bit every 7 terabytes or something, and that was basically undetectable before ZFS. And so they've lodged a bunch of bugs, discovered these bugs as things that were previously assumed studly. One of the best examples of data corruption is external vibrations. Loud sounds actually can cause it can actually cause data corruption, but usually this causes performance decreases. And I searched hard for this video, and unfortunately I couldn't find it anymore. I don't know where I put it. I should have bookmarked it or something. But there was this great demo of DTrace where it can do it will put in probes for your I/O, and it will be able to measure with pretty great fidelity, like what your I/O status is. And so they end up hooking up the charts and they into this one server in a server room, and he goes up to this rack-bound server and he just screams at the server, and you could actually see from him screaming at the server the IO going down, because at that point, you know, the heads on the spinning platters are having a hard time tracking, and they could even be knocked off track, because remember, these tracks are really, really, really small on these spinning platters, and they would have to reseek to the right track, and you could totally see that, you know, that this a loud environment would actually cause your computer to get slower. So that's
wow.
Yeah. So that's why you work in perfect silence, right, Andrew? So you want a fast computer.
Sure.
Just roll with me here. I'm running low on time, so I'll skip a couple of these. Another great thing about it is I mentioned the causes. So it actually implements it tracks all your data with checksums, and it uses a Fletcher, which I actually haven't heard of before, but it's apparently a checksumming style system, or uses a SHA-256 checksums. And what it does is that it works surprisingly like how Git works internally, with hash trees, otherwise known as Merkle trees. And so that if a single bit gets flipped anywhere, basically the entire tree gets invalidated. So it's a great way to notice single bit errors. And based on the way that ZFS does redundancy, is that then it can go over to the next disk over, or in some cases, actually the same disk, because you can actually tell ZFS to store duplicate copies of your data on a single disk, and it can then auto repair any single bit errors, or not even single bit, just, you know, it can go over to the other block and see if that one matches the hash it should have. And if it does, then it can repair it for you and let you know that happened. And letting you know is pretty important. And so that's it's pretty great. It also has a bunch of other features. And I mentioned kind of like how I would want transactional snapshotting in Time Machine. With that type of function, except at a much deeper level and a better level, is built in to ZFS. That you can have ZFS has copy and write semantics. So it turns out that making a snapshot of a live volume is actually very, very cheap. And another interesting aspect of that is that you can do writable snapshots. So what ends up happening then is that you have two independent file systems that share a set of blocks. There's this project called Docker kind of like para-virtualization. Well, it's not. It is para-virtualization. So instead of kind of a heavy virtualization of, like, say, a VMware or Parallels, it's more of instead of pretending to be a whole new machine inside a machine, it's a single Linux kernel that it does a better job at segregating these virtual machines, for lack of a better term, into containers. And I forget what file system technology it uses, but it kind of hinges on much the same concept. But that type of technology is built into ZFS. And one of the cool things about these snapshots is that you can send and receive snapshots for cheap remote backups. So you can take a snapshot and then efficiently transmit that snapshot over to another drive that's offsite, and vice versa. So I already mentioned, so getting to the cons of ZFS. That I already mentioned that basically one of the big cons is that this is not for you. That on the Mac, it's a sad story. You're not going to get it anytime soon. But there's a few other issues here. Just from an architectural standpoint, ZFS unifies and combines both the file system and logical volume management. And this turns out to be, some people actually consider it to be what would be the term here? It's a violation of kind of the separation of concerns type thing, where there's this idea that they really should be different and they should be independent of one another. And because it combines them, it kind of turns this into this monolithic system that that ends up being kind of hard to shoehorn into traditional operating systems. like typically how operating systems evolve is that you have the file systems, and then later on they might add logical volume management to them. And the fact that ZFS wants to be both kind of most operating systems didn't evolve that path. They kind of are independent systems. And so not only is ZFS complex in general, but the fact that it kind of unifies these concepts makes it hard to apply to existing operating systems. One of the things that causes this trouble is that with this unification is that it's actually pretty hard to boot from a ZFS system, because you kind of need like different parts of the operating system up that you wouldn't think would need to be up in order to get the a boot going. It's kind of a catch-22 type thing. But that said, you know, obviously Solaris can boot from ZFS and FreeBSD can. So it takes a good amount of work, but you definitely can do it. And probably in practicality, the biggest problem is that ZFS itself tends to be pretty resource heavy. That this is not just like a file system that runs in a megabyte of RAM or something like this. This is doing a heavy duty amount of work, and especially from what I understand, that if you enable its deduplicating feature, or where it will notice duplicate data and will save you that space, that I understand this is something that it almost wants. I think like basically the more memory you can throw at it, the better. But it definitely seems to want like a gig by itself type stuff, which and it sounds like a lot. But on the other hand, if I have a file system that can guarantee non-data corruption, take as much memory as you need, because the entire point of the file system is to actually store my data correctly. And I think that's pretty important. And of course, there's also the political issue that I mentioned that Sun wrote ZFS. And of course, now it's owned by Oracle, which has the Oracle taint on it. And unfortunately, Sun has their own open source license called the CDDL, and it seems like pretty much everyone believes that's incompatible with the GPL. So this is why ZFS exists on Solaris, which because Solaris was released under the CDDL as well, and is also on FreeBSD, which is under a BSD license, but it's not on Linux, because apparently the CDDL and the GPL are supposedly incompatible with each other. So for kind of crappy political reasons, and not just technical reasons, many people believe that you can't do one distribution that has both ZFS and the Linux kernel at the same time. Which kind of leads us to ButterFS, which is another, unfortunately, Oracle file system owned by Oracle, but it is GPL'd. So it is compatible with Linux, and in fact is included on Linux kernels. And it's in many of the features of ButterFS, feel like they came from the ZFS playbook, but it's ButterFS in many ways is almost more advanced, because it has like this it leverages one data structure, not just one, but primarily one, and which are the copy and write B trees, and it uses this one feature, this one design, this one data structure, and it implements it in it implements almost everything in terms of that one feature. So it uses the same structure for almost everything. And so it's like internally it's this beautiful design. And I've been following ButterFS for a number of years now. And it's actually included in a few Linux distributions, and even is marked as production ready. But I don't know, it's like every time I go to use it, it seems like I see too many people still mentioning that it's experimental or something. And it also doesn't have a lot of the features that ZFS already has. So it ends up being this thing where it's like everyone just keeps on running EXT3 or EXT4 and are kind of waiting for, Butter to kind of grow into the ZFS shoes. And of course, on the Mac, it's just, we're just lost and we have no hope. But.
Well, right. It's because it's GPL'd, right? So it could never.
Apple includes GPL software in Mac OS X.
They're trying to include as yes. good of it as possible.
And I think they're even going the direction of trying to more and more get rid of the GPL stuff.
Well, especially because of the GPL 3.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if ButterFS is under GPL 2 or GPL 3?
I believe it's GPL 2, but I'm not 100% sure on that. And I'll kind of talk about where... So that's the present. It's ButterFS seems to be pretty much the way Linux is going forward. If you want ZFS today, you probably want to use a SmartOS or OpenSolaris or something like that. On the Mac, you're just screwed. But of course, all of these file systems were kind of targeting spinning platters, the old style hard drives. Of course,
right.
the present and the future are SSDs. And so SSDs are very interesting because they only pretend to be dumb block devices. And every SSD has its own internal file system. And Valley Aurora wrote for the Linux Weekly News, log structured file systems, there's one in every SSD, where she kind of details some of this, and I'll include a link to that. And Adam H. Leventhal, who worked on ZFS, at least he's a ZFS fan if he didn't work on ZFS, but I've been following him for a while, and he's been talking about ZFS for a long time. And he recently wrote for the ACMQ, a file system all its own, where he talks about how it's kind of weird because we have file systems, we know them today, but SSDs have their own file system, and he calls this the flash translation layer. So basically the problem is that both the granularity and fundamental operations differ between what our traditional file systems offer and how flash works. An example of that is that with flash you have garbage collection. And this is why it's important that you have the trim command so that the file system can actually inform the SSD that a block is no longer being used, because that turns out that the more you fill an SSD, the slower it gets. So the SSD actually has to know when a block is not being used. You have to do wear leveling, which is you only can write to a flash cell so many times before it's dead. So if you were to work like a hard drive where this constantly updating whatever was holding a commonly used block, you'd probably kill your SSD probably in a couple weeks. So you'd have to spread out the writes across many different cells. And then there's a problem of write amplification, that because flash needs to be erased before it's written, and also flash tends to deal with larger pages than what file systems tend to deal with. File systems tend to deal with 4K chunks. But between 512 byte and 4K chunks, flash pages tend to be 8K, maybe even bigger than that, 16K. And so one 4K write can easily result in many times that cell's being updated, that it needs to, for the aware leveling, it needs to keep track of where it's put that block in that next cell over. It also needs to erase that before it can write that cell over. And then it needs to store it with it has one 4K of update, but it needs to read it and update it with, it needs to slot that 4K in next to all the rest of the data that hasn't been updated. So it turns out that modern SSDs actually will do data compression in order to lessen the need for write amplification. And supposedly that even gets it to sub 1.0 levels, where that one 4K write will maybe only results in one cell being written. So your SSD is actually doing data compression. It's also doing, more of these are doing deduplication, where they actually will notice when you are storing the same data, and they will thus only store that data once. And I actually wrote a program called Stress Drive, which I'll link to, which was my attempt to deal with a broken SSD and making sure it actually would store all the data that it says it can store in the face of a deduplication. And it's also doing error correction. I don't exactly know the failure modes for these flash cells, but obviously you have over-provisioning, where you have the drive says it has less cells, less capacity than it actually has, and that as cells are destroyed, it just goes into its little cache and starts pulling from its bag, saying, okay, you can start using this one. So there's a ton of stuff going on there. And what's really scary is that all these SSDs and these really amazingly complicated file systems are all, they're epoxied into the box that we don't know how they work, and none of them are open source. Well, I don't want to say none of them, but pretty much they're a black box. And these are, even simple RAID firmware tends to be buggy. This is what I've found in production, and what ZFS, the testing of it, kind of bore out, is that, and these, RAID 5 systems and stuff like that, they're not nearly as complicated as the type of virtual file systems that are being pulled off inside your little SSD. So there's a ton of bugs, I guarantee you, in those. But that said, that Samsung is, I know, announced a project called the Flash Friendly File System, and they're open sourcing that. And I think eventually what's going to happen is that it doesn't make sense for each of these SSD manufacturers to have their own little, their own file system. And I think there was a project called OpenSSD, which tried to actually have an open source standard for these types of features that all SSDs must have. But that didn't really take off. And kind of the thrust of Adam Levinsohn's article was that you have the file system, which has its own semantics, and you have the flash file systems, or the flash translation layers, that have its own semantics. And they don't really mesh. And one is kind of existing for the purpose of the other. And I think this is where the future, where Apple actually is uniquely in a unique position to deliver this, is that instead of having these files, traditional file systems that don't match onto SSDs as we have them now, and SSDs that have this complicated mapping, that Apple's in a good place to actually write a flash native file system, where you take away all the custom firmware that tries to make these SSDs seem like they're spinning Rust, and actually writing, taking out the two middlemen and being able to address these cells directly. Apple already kind of led that in terms of hardware, that you buy an SSD in most notebooks, and they come in these form factors that look like little 2.5-inch hard drives, when really, they're the chips. And with the MacBook Air, Apple was a leader of actually taking out those, taking it out of that form factor and the soldering the flash right onto the motherboard there. And so imagine if they could go one step further, where instead of I assume that there's still that custom firmware involved. But imagine if OS X could eventually learn to speak to these flash cells directly, and all that crazy custom firmware gets pulled into Darwin, and Apple can lead the charge there. That said, Apple's always been behind the curve in terms of implementing file systems, except maybe for the original MFS. And so I don't expect Apple to actually do this. But like I said, they control the hardware, they control the software. They would be in a great position to do this. And that would be a great announcement, although I think only file system geeks like me would actually care.
Well, you in Syracuse.
Right. Well, I said file system geeks like me.
That's true. I think that they would probably only do it if they could see a specific economic advantage to it. Like if they could get faster, faster phones without paying any more for the chips.
Mm.
They would get a major advantage over other, phone manufacturers.
Yeah, it's definitely
they might do it
from the phone factor. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and considering that they haven't done anything with HFS Plus, you would figure that if they are planning on anything over the next couple of years, because they were planning to some degree or another, like the Intel transition for years before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
If they are trying to do any skunkworks kind of things, it's almost certainly going to have to do with SSD rather than HFS Plus.
Yep, yep.
So, yep. Okay, so that's it?
That's it.
All righty. To see show notes for this episode, go to edgecasesshow.com, all one word, /59, and we'll see you next time.